You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week. So today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin, the host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Margaret Carmel, also with BoiseDev.com, James Dawson, who covers the legislature for Boise State Public Radio News, and Troy Oppie, who not only reports for Boise State Public Radio News, but also has a pretty cool jazz show. It is called Jazz Conversations, and it's on Boise State Public Radio Music. Oh, happy Friday, everybody.
Who's not here?
I know. Everyone. We just decided to bring everybody on today.
Sorry, Kevin Richard, you're out this week.
So, you know, there has been so much news, honestly, this last week, and a lot of it making national headlines. The big one, Troy, yesterday was something that I think no parent wants to ever hear about or get word about, and this was a shooting at a school in Rigby. Can you tell us what happened and tell us where we are now with this?
Yeah, so there's still a lot that is unknown, certainly, as these type of events unfold, things that law enforcement can't say or that they simply don't know yet. What we do know is a middle school student, a sixth grader identified as a female student, shot three people. There were three victims, two fellow students and an adult employee at the school who was identified as a custodian by media reports. And I should say, lots of folks on the ground over there, including, you know, local papers, the Post Register, the television stations from Idaho Falls, Idaho Ed News had people there, all did an excellent job, in my opinion, covering a traumatic and breaking event. So a lot of things are relying on their work. A lot of the information that came out yesterday was relying on their work. All the victims had non-life-threatening injuries. Officials in a press conference yesterday said that there were injured in extremities. The adult victim was treated and released. They called that injury a through and through. He was released yesterday. The juvenile victims were held overnight. One, they said, may need surgery at a later date, but there were no fatalities. We don't know yet a motive. We don't know yet how the sixth grade alleged shooter got the handgun. East Idaho News reported last night that the Idaho Falls Regional Bomb Squad was at a house in Idaho Falls doing a search that was connected to the shooting. I have not independently been able to confirm that, and there has been no information since about that. So still a lot that we do not know about that shooting, which was the second school shooting, it would seem, in the state of Idaho since 1999.
And Troy, the sixth grader, the perpetrator in this, she is in custody, correct?
Correct. She was detained by a teacher at the school until law enforcement got there and took custody of her. So certainly a very brave, a very, I'm sure, emotional incident. There's no school over there today. The district mm-hmm. announced that they would keep everybody home. They have counselors available to talk if that's necessary as the community deals with this event.
Yeah. I just think, you know, you think about it, sixth grade, those are 11 and 12 year olds. We shouldn't be shocked, but I am still shocked by just how young these children are when this happens. So I appreciate your update on that, Troy. And of course, we will keep you updated here on Boise State Public Radio News as we learn more about this. Shifting gears, Melissa and Jimmy, I know both of you can talk a little bit more about this, but some developing news coming in regards to Reclaim Idaho. Melissa, maybe we can start with you on this.
Yes, Gemma, Reclaim Idaho has just sued. They filed a petition to the Supreme Court of Idaho over the bill that was signed into law by Governor Little 3 weeks ago. About voter initiatives. And this, if you recall, it would tighten up the restrictions restrictions, or sorry, the requirements for getting a voter initiative onto the ballot. Currently, or before this law was signed, it was 18 of Idaho's 35 legislative districts needing 6% of voters from those districts to get a voter initiative onto the ballot for the next general election. This would require 6% of voters from all of Idaho's 35 districts. The petitioners, Reclaim Idaho and the Committee to Protect and Preserve the Idaho Constitution, argue that it is unconstitutionally restrictive. And there are some pretty big power players who are supporting this lawsuit, including former Secretary of State Ben Yasursa, who points out in his declaration, among other things, that this new law would give just one legislative district veto power over what potentially 34 other districts want. It is a very, very high bar. I think that even supporters agree that it's a high bar. And so that it's a lengthy lawsuit. It just came out. We got it less than half an hour ago in our inboxes. I'm still going through it. I know that Jimmy is too. But this is certainly a developing story that we're going to keep an eye on.
Jimmy, join us on this, and because as Melissa said, I mean, I know you're still breaking down the details of this.
Yeah, I mean, this is a 130-page lawsuit, so I just got a copy myself about, you know, right when we were going.
You haven't read
air.
The whole thing?
Surprisingly not. You know, my speed reading skills aren't quite up to par at the moment, but, you know, like Melissa said, the critics of this bill say that, hey, basically this would essentially make it statistically impossible, unless you had a whole lot of money coming into your campaign, to try to get something on the ballot. Yeah, Idaho lawmakers tried this a couple years ago after Reclaim Idaho successfully brought the Medicaid expansion initiative forward, and Idaho voters approved it fairly overwhelmingly, more than certainly other voter initiative petitions had legalized or approved the Medicaid expansion initiative in other states across the country. So this isn't quite as far-reaching as that effort had been. Not only did they want to expand the number of districts they needed to qualify, they wanted to increase the amount of signatures and pretty much cut in a third the time that campaigns have to get those signatures. Brad Little did veto both of those bills a couple years ago, saying that he questioned the constitutionality. He said in his letter explaining his signature on this particular bill that, you know, those questions of constitutionality are still up in the air for him, but he signed it saying that ultimately it should be, you know, an answer that's coming from the courts to determine whether or not that's true.
I mean, so which I find that interesting, Jimmy, right? That the governor signs this knowing full well that the state's going to get sued.
Well, and especially because if you read his veto letter from a couple years ago, he said he worried about signing those two bills because he didn't want the, you know, quote, liberal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to really reshape Idaho's ballot initiative law. We should say that ballot initiatives are not, you know, something that's, you know, equal across the country. There are only about half of states in D.C. that allow them. But you know, it's really up to each state. And we kind of saw this last year when Reclaim Idaho sued to get their K-12 funding initiative back on the ballot, which a federal judge here said, yeah, let's do that. And then it got rejected eventually down the line and got overturned. But, you know, federal courts are kind of weary on, you know, forcing states that have the ballot initiative law within them to really shape those policies. So I'm not sure if that concern was well founded by Governor Little at the time, but you know, he's certainly leaving it up to courts now.
Don, can we talk about a story that really impacted so many people in the last week? And this is the unexpected and just tragic death of Lisa Holland. For people who may not be familiar with who Lisa was, can you tell us a little bit more about her?
Yeah. Lisa Holland was the economic development director for the city of Cuna, and was also on the Planning and Zoning Commission for the city of Meridian. those are her job titles, but she was really ingrained within much of the Boise community. And I just heard from people, the gentleman who owns the business that works in the building that I work in knew her well and was pretty upset. My wife walked in and was like, oh my gosh, I went to high school with her. My mother was like, my old boss was her mother-in-law. And just, I mean, I was just astounded by how many people knew her. And when people die, especially young, Lisa was 34, I think it's easy for people to say, oh, they were just such a nice person. But this went to another level of people who knew her, found her to be kind and caring. The way she died was in a vehicle accident near Mountain Home on Saturday. Idaho State Police hasn't given a lot of details on what happened, and I've heard things, but of course won't speculate beyond the facts. But she was in a vehicle with her husband, her sister, and a juvenile. I think it's okay to say that the juvenile was her 7-month-old son. And she died, her 7-month-old son, Milo, died, and her sister died. Her husband was taken to the hospital. And it's just one of those stories that I think anytime we lose a member of our community, it's hard on all of us. And we all realize that life is precious and short.
Yeah.
And holding on to those people we love is really important every day, not to get overly philosophical. But it really impacted people this week. And, you know, I had only interviewed her once, but she was just super helpful with the story. And I think that's the kind of person that people say that she was.
And I think, too, it shows, Dawn, you know, no matter how big Boise and the Treasure Valley gets, man, it is still a small town when something like this happens.
It really is. And we are growing. But it's amazing how quickly people knit into our community. We really are, it really is a place where people in general care for their neighbors. And this is one of those things where I think it shows that.
Yeah. Okay, we need to get into the legislative session. And Melissa, let's start with the fact that in the middle of a seemingly never-ending session, the legislature is recessing again.
Yes, and this is an entirely unexpected after some issues with previous vetoes at the end of the session and the legislature wanting to overturn those vetoes. And so lawmakers have largely, not entirely, but largely wrapped up their business for this regular session, with a few outliers, of course. But right now, the goal is to recess for 5 legislative days. That gives them time to see if Governor Little is going to veto any of the bills that they really want to pass. And that would give them a chance to overturn or attempt to overturn those vetoes if necessary. And there are a couple, I'm sure, that lawmakers and legislative leadership are keeping an eye on, especially, you know, round 2 of trying to chip away at the governor's executive powers in cases of extreme emergency. But regardless of what happens, they are now guaranteed to break the record for the longest legislative session in Idaho's history. Previously, that was 119 days. They're going to blast through that record after tomorrow.
All right. Well, with that being said, they still have work to get done. Margaret, one thing that folks have really been keeping their eye on is the property tax bill. You've been following this. Can you talk about and get us updated on what is going on with that?
So I think it's safe to say that the number one issue in Idaho when you talk to voters right now is property taxes. I think everyone has seen massive, especially in the Treasure Valley, have seen massive increases in their property tax bills as values are going up. And a lot of this is due to the fact that residential homes are increasing in value faster than commercial property. And so there's been a lot of back and forth this session about exactly what they're going to do about this. a bill early in the session that was going to cap local government budgets, and that's all it was going to do, died on the Senate floor by one vote. So what they came back after weeks of kind of backroom talks, they came up with a compromise, and this compromise makes zero people happy. I don't think there's anybody who likes every single piece of this bill. And what it does is it's going to up the homeowner's exemption to $125,000, which opponents say is not high enough. It's going to increase the amount of aid you can get as a low-income homeowner or a senior on a fixed income to $1,500 a year. But that's going to be partially paid for starting in 2022 by kicking roughly 15% of the people in the program off, because only because homes worth more than 125% of the median in the county will no longer be able to participate. Then on the local government budget side, it's going to cap budgets and say that it's going to put a cap on that budgets can only grow 5% with new construction. So in places like Star, Nampa, CUNA, you know, you're seeing double digit growth in these new growth every year because there's these sprawling neighborhoods. And so now the amount that budget can grow is now going to be capped at 5% on top of the 3% they're already allowed to take. So that's a total of 8%. It's also going to say that cities can only take, they can't take the full amount of property taxes that come back after an urban renewal district sunsets. It's going to say cities can only take 1% of foregone taxes every year, which are ones that basically, if the city decides they don't want to raise taxes one year, they can claw that back later. So that's going to be capped. So there's a lot of, and there's also some changes to personal property taxes. Businesses can now take up to $250,000 in personal property tax investments. So there's a lot of little pieces here. And there's even more that I didn't even get into. And a lot of the criticism of this was saying, well, why did we have, after months of talks, why is this all we got? And there's, you know, critics were saying this wasn't going to do enough to provide relief. But, you know, supporters were saying this is the best we could do right now. It's better to do this than do nothing. And so I think a lot of people are going to be watching these property tax numbers to see how much this is going to help people, assuming the governor signs the bill.
So that's where we're at with it right now, Margaret. We're waiting to see what the governor does.
Yes. So sorry, that was not clear. Both houses have signed the bill or have passed the bill. And there was bipartisan opposition in both chambers to this legislation, but it was not enough to overturn it in either vote. So now it's gone to Governor Little, and we're going to see if he signs it. I heard a reference that the governor was somewhat involved in these talks to put this compromise together. If that's true, maybe he, you know, it's likely he will sign it. You know, we'll see. I don't, you know, you don't want to get into that speculation game.
Right. Not at all. So Jimmy, where are we in regards to executive powers? So are there more post veto bills? So we know that the governor did not sign two of these bills, but now there could be other legislation, and this is like executive orders during extreme emergencies.
Yes. So what you just referenced, there were two bills that the governor vetoed a few weeks ago that would have significantly limited a governor's power during an emergency. Again, he vetoed both of them. The Senate could not override either of them. The House did override one of them. But of course, when it went to the Senate, it died. So there are now four different bills that were proposed, and they just kind of are watered down versions of what they had already sent to the governor's desk. One of which was said, at least on the floor of the Senate, to be a compromise with the governor. So seemingly that should have his approval. But that one specifically dealt with emergency powers during some kind of terrorist attack or domestic, you know, extreme emergency, essentially. And that would have the legislature come back after 90 days if nothing had been, you know, figured out by that point. The other three essentially would take little bits and pieces of the other bill, at least the House version of it, during natural disasters, for example, or other types of emergencies that the governor couldn't limit gathering sizes, couldn't restrict jobs based on classification, and things like that. So, you know, those, as far as I remember, passed on party line votes roughly, or near party line votes in both the House and Senate. It's unclear whether the governor is going to accept those, since essentially they have the same types of philosophy, you know, going into that. But lawmakers said, look, you know, our constituents sent us here to, you know, try to address this issue. They didn't like the way that the pandemic was handled, at least the ones that reached out to them anyway. And we need to do something before we leave.
Okay. Troy, one thing that we do know that Governor Little signed was a bill about wolf killings.
Yeah. So Senate Bill 1211, signed by the governor yesterday afternoon. That's the bill that conservation and wolf advocates say could essentially wipe 90% of the state's wolves away, which would return the species into the threshold of needing endangered species protection again. It allows nighttime hunting, hunting on ATVs and motorized vehicles, which I am not a sportsman. I'm not a hunter, but I do know folks who are, and none of them would consider, you know, using those types of vehicles to be a fair fight. There are other considerations that this bill did. It doubled the depredation fund, which is money that comes from the state. They took it out of the fish and game budget, and it is used to pay for wolf killing, official state sanctioned wolf killing efforts by state officials and external contractors. Conservation groups say they're evaluating their legal options. The group Center for Biological Diversity sent a letter earlier this week asking for the federal government to stop sending Idaho federal funds to manage species, because you know, they claim the state is not being a good steward of those funds that are used to protect species. That seems to be the biggest arrow in the quiver that they have for now. 10 years ago, when wolves were taken off the endangered species list, lawsuits to prevent that were unsuccessful. That's something to watch in the coming weeks, the coming months, what potential actions might be. They're working something up, but they haven't said specifically what that might be just yet.
So let's get away from politics for a minute. And Don, can you talk about what's going on at the Boise Town Square Mall in regards to the old Sears property? I read this article yesterday on BoiseTown.com, and I'm still like, really?
Yeah, sometimes I read my own articles and I think that. So you all probably remember that the Sears store at Boise Town Square closed in 2019, as so many Sears stores have done. And it sat empty, except for a quick run as a Halloween store. It's been on the market, ostensibly for lease, by a private equity firm called Seritage, which takes its name from Sears. But we found out this week that Seritage sold it, and the company that owns it is based on the East Coast and wouldn't respond to me, other than basically a short statement that said that they hoped to redevelop the Sears store in Boise and one other into a mixed-use development that could include both housing and retail. I checked in with the folks who own the mall, which is confusingly owned separately from the Sears store. And they said they were aware of the sale, but don't know what the plan is. There's some contractual agreements in the way that, like, the parking lots work and the entrance, you know, between the mall and the store works. So we'll see what's going to happen. We don't know a lot of details yet. This seems a little weird, I think, at first glance. Paul J. Schneider, long of Boise KBOI fame, said, I couldn't live in a place without windows. And I said, well, I think they would probably redevelop it so that it has, like, windows and balconies. I think he was trying to be funny.
Right.
But we'll see. There's actually a pretty big chunk of land there. There's a lot of parking that is fairly underutilized. You know, malls are built with parking lots to accommodate like 1992 Black Friday crowds. Well, it's not like that anymore. So there's a lot of space there. We'll see what happens. I imagine that this is going to take some time to roll out, and we'll keep trying to get some more answers. But yeah, you might be able to live at the mall.
I tell you, hey, anything these days, right? Right. We'll take a quick break, and we will have more with our reporter roundtable next. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Continuing our reporter roundtable with Melissa Davlin, the host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Don Day and Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com, and our own reporters, James Dawson and Troy Oppie. Jimmy, we talked about this yesterday on Idaho Matters, but for people who did not listen, the higher ed bill did finally pass.
It did, yes, with a $2.5 million reduction spread across the four colleges and universities. I believe Boise State took a $1.5 million hit. And for full disclosure, Boise State does hold our broadcasting license, but doesn't have any editorial say in what we put on the air. So the bill's passed really under the specter of the social justice education debate, with far-right lawmakers continuing to insist that, not only are the universities indoctrinating children, but, we got to watch out for it in K-12 schools too, which is why they passed another bill that essentially forbid teachers from compelling students to believe certain viewpoints, which they say was found in things like critical race theory. And so this week you had in the Senate, for example, Democrats and some Republicans saying, why should we be punishing the universities for potentially teaching some of these viewpoints, though not necessarily compelling them? This is not a problem. According to them, we haven't really seen much evidence that, this is a widespread issue, or that, kids are being forced to believe certain viewpoints. And meanwhile, you have some Republican hardliners saying, no, like my granddaughter who's attending high school right now, or other people that they know have approached them saying that, they took a certain class at Boise State, or, a specific high school across the state where they were being taught inappropriate things, according to them, and that their conservative viewpoints were being kind of pushed down, and that they were meant to feel othered, essentially. And so the other thing that opponents of this say could, potentially happen next year is that this could be just a slippery slope to potentially, taking more money away from universities, which, even though at least all of us or all of them in Idaho stayed open during the pandemic and welcomed back some more than others, students to in-person classes, we saw a lot of people coming from out of state, students coming, so they could have an in-person classroom experience. But they're worried that, they still are needing more money to make up for the hits that they saw during the pandemic from a loss of events, holding events, things like that. And that, lawmakers could be asking for further cuts down the road. And we saw that with Representative Ron Nate, who wanted to cut another $18 million from the state's higher ed budget, too. That did fail when it was in the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee. But it's certainly a feeling that, he and other lawmakers who agree with his viewpoint are trying to push for. And I would imagine that it's coming back next year, too.
And Don, your Gretchen Parsons actually had a chance to talk with Boise State University President Dr. Marlene Trump.
Yeah, so we hired Gretchen to launch a new morning newsletter product, Idaho First, this week. And one of the things that she set up in advance was a really great podcast interview with Dr. Trump. And they had a really wide-ranging discussion. They talked quite a bit about housing on campus. She made this point that obviously there's a lot of for-profit housing projects going on that Margaret and I have covered, but that doesn't always provide the most fulfilling experience for students who may want to start their college experience in more of a dorm environment. Gretchen talked to her about what the biggest challenge was in her 2 years as president, and no surprise, she talked about COVID. And she also talked about how she hopes to travel the state this summer and really hear from Idahoans and help craft solutions that can help Idahoans, young Idahoans who are living in rural areas, be able to get a university experience in ways that may look different than they have in the past. She also talked about the future of Albertsons Stadium. And here's a bit of that interview. Let's take a listen.
In the past, we've discussed renovating that east side of Albertsons Stadium. And we're very, very fortunate to have this fantastic new leadership in athletics. So Jeremiah Dickey and his team will take a deep dive into all of our facilities and prioritize the needs. Our most important priority could still end up being Albertsons Stadium, but they have to go through that process. And so right now, they're still in the midst of that, and it makes it impossible to really say what is the next step for Albertsons Stadium.
So pretty interesting. We've been following plans to expand the east side for quite a while. And before the pandemic, we had a story infamously based on public records. You know, Boise State holds your broadcast license, and I'm always asking for public records, so it always feels awkward to talk about it on your air. But
Don't worry about it.
I know, editorially independent, as am I. So there's some big ideas there to expand the concourse, to upgrade the lower bowl, to add a new academic center and really change the look of the stadium along Broadway. But Dr. Tromp, they're kind of saying, yeah, maybe not yet. We're trying to figure that out. And so interesting times, as they always are, as Jimmy mentioned with the legislation and all the things that Dr. Tromp talked about. And I know we'll all be watching to see what comes in the next year, because I think it's going to be quite a ride.
To say the least. So, Melissa... Yeah, right. Melissa, last week there was an ethics hearing at the State House. This was regarding now former Representative Aaron Von Ellinger and the rape allegations against him. You know, we've had listeners email us wanting to know what's going on in regards to the harassment that his 19-year-old accuser has faced, and many say faced by other legislators.
Right. Right now I have to make it clear that it isn't yet clear if there will be any repercussions for representatives who have linked to blog posts that expose the identity of Jane Doe. It isn't clear if there are any ethics complaints against them right now, but it is clear that this has drawn a lot of outrage. After Jane Doe testified, she was harassed in the hallway by people who had shown up to support Ammon Bundy in the lead up to her, Representative Aaron Von Ellinger. These are women who have shown up to also support Ammon Bundy at his at his hearings and at other related events. And so there are a lot of people who are very, very upset. Also, in the lead up to Jane Doe's testimony, she saw harassment online, a lot of people calling her names, saying she was part of a honey trap meant to basically entrap Representative Von Ellinger. So pretty horrific harassment. And I think, you know, one of the things that we're talking about on Idaho Reports today is whether that is going to affect people, you know, especially women in the future who want to report harassment or inappropriate comments at the Idaho legislature.
Right. Absolutely. And I think you're right, Melissa, that we'll have to see how that, you know, how that does play out. I mean, it definitely gives a chilling effect, I would say. Margaret, so you've talked about this before on the program, and this is the city of Boise's housing bonus ordinance. For folks who aren't familiar, can you explain what that is and then what's going on with it right now?
So at the end of 2020, the very end, the city of Boise passed this housing bonus ordinance. It's kind of complicated, but basically what it does is it says that if developers build in ways that the city likes, then they will let them build with more density, more units, more apartments, taller buildings. And there's a couple pieces to this. One of the pieces is affordable housing. You know, if a developer chooses to set aside a certain percentage of units for people making under certain incomes, they can get these bonuses. The other part of it is if developers build in locations near public transit or near services like, you know, jobs, restaurants, food, shopping, they can get more density, you know, so that there's, you know, ostensibly less traffic because it's a walkable area. And for the first time, a developer took advantage of this project on a 2-acre empty parcel right across the street from the mall on Cole Road. And prior to using the ordinance, this developer would only be able to build 90 apartments on this lot. Now, because they were allowed to add a fifth floor through this housing bonus ordinance, they were able to build 136 apartments. And so this is interesting because this is the first time this ordinance has been used. Because when the city council passed it, they were thinking, all right, we're going to see if people are going to use this. And if they don't, we're going to have to come back and tweak it, or we're going to see how people use it. And so this did not use the affordable housing part of the bonus. This only used the location part of the bonus because it was across the street from the mall. So I'm going to be curious to see as more of these applications roll in, who's using this bonus, how many extra units it added, and if it got us any slightly lower rent units out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Jimmy, update us on the Ninth Circuit hearing in regards to transgender athletes.
So this was a law that was passed last year by the legislature, signed into law by Governor Brad Little, that would prevent any transgender girl or woman from competing on a sports team that aligned with their gender identity. It didn't apply to transgender men or boys, and it was challenged immediately after the governor signed it, pretty much, and a federal judge in Idaho issued a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction to prevent it from going into place. So not only did Idaho, but another outside group, Alliance Defending Freedom, they appealed that to the Ninth Circuit, which was heard in oral arguments on Monday. We've heard pretty much the same argument this entire time for about a year and a half, that at least the state and Alliance Defending Freedom say, you know, transgender girls and women have some kind of innate, you know, advantage over who they call biological girls and women, you know, depending on when, you know, a person transitioned. If they went through puberty, they might have, you know, more bone density, bigger lung and heart capacity, things like that, that could give them an advantage. Plus, you know, depending on their testosterone level, something along those lines. Whereas, you know, the people who are fighting for this law to be overturned, including Lindsay Hecox, who's a former Boise State University student who tried out for the track and cross country teams, didn't eventually make it. And she's taking a break right now, but her lawyer said that she's going to apply to come back in the fall. Say that that's not true, you know, that science is you know, not actually accurate. You know, the NCAA and Idaho High School Activities Association, previously their policy, at least in Idaho, was you could compete on these teams that align with your gender identity if you undergo hormones replacement therapy for a year, which essentially gets your testosterone down to a certain level and brings up your estrogen levels. So you know, you got a couple weird legal issues going on here. Alliance Defending Freedom is saying that, well, now that Lindsay Hecox is no longer a student at Boise State University and, you know, didn't make the teams, why does she have standing to bring this lawsuit in the first place? Which essentially means, you know, what harm came to her since she wasn't denied, you know, a spot on the team because of her gender identity, and she doesn't even attend a school now that, you know, potentially she could join a team. And that's the argument too. There's another unnamed, you know, woman on this lawsuit that she's in high school in Boise, and she doesn't want to have to face a gender verification test, which could be brought by a parent, a student, you know, anyone really could challenge whether or not this person or any kind of athlete is a woman playing on a women's sports team. And that would require a doctor, going and, you know, examining, you know, an athlete's genitals, or taking some kind of chromosomal test to prove that, you know, you're a biological female, or measuring their testosterone. So right now this is in the hands of a 3-judge panel with the Ninth Circuit. This law has had many clones spawn over the course of the last year. Several states have passed similar legislation, and all eyes are really on the Ninth Circuit to see whether or not this is actually legal. The Trump administration originally sent in, you know, a brief saying we support this law, we very much want this to stay in place. And when President Biden took office, he ordered the Justice Department under him withdrew that brief in support of it, and they've been very supportive of transgender rights across the country. So they obviously withdrew their support for that.
And Melissa, there's now a bill that would ban advertising of any Schedule I controlled substance. So basically, like, you couldn't advertise for marijuana sales, I'm assuming, in our neighbors to the west who have legalized it.
That's exactly the point, Gemma. This is a bill that was introduced by Senator C. Scott Grove from Meridian. He said that it just occurred to him very recently that this was a problem that he wanted to address. And so I'll add that this is one of the side effects of the legislature being here for so long, is that we get bills like this that haven't really had the chance to have robust public hearings. But basically, this legislation would do exactly that. It would ban the advertising of pot shops, marijuana products in Idaho. Of course, are, as you said, our neighbors to the west have legalized. Idaho has not. That has not stopped some of those businesses from advertising in Idaho. And so it brought up a lot of questions about the First Amendment. It brought up a lot of questions about process, too. The fact that this did come so late, that it wasn't very well noticed that this was going to be in a public hearing. There are a lot of questions, I think, about the constitutionality of this. There are, of course, different standards that apply to commercial speech as opposed to general public speech. But the fact of the matter is, this has not had that robust public debate. And so we don't know the constitutional complications of this kind of proposal. It did pass the Senate. We don't know what, if any, action the House might take. We'll see next week.
I want to thank all of you for coming in. Holy cow, we got a lot accomplished, but we didn't even hit everything you guys sent to me. So thank you so much for all of your in-depth reporting. Melissa Davlin, Margaret Carmel, Don Day, James Dawson, Troy Oppie. Thank you all. Have a good weekend as we wrap the week up. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thanks, Gemma.
And I want to thank all of you, of course, for joining us every day. Appreciate you taking the time out of your day to be a part of Idaho Matters. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. And a big thank you to our fantastic senior engineer, Kelsey Black, for making sure that we stay on the air. It's always a good thing when you do a live show. Our executive producers are Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. Remember, if you have an email, if you have a thought, a question, a comment, maybe an idea for the show, send us that email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. As I said, it's Friday. I hope you have a good weekend. I'm Gemma Gaudette, and we will, of course, see you back here on Monday.